kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me in my
life. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with the latest on health and healing. No more fillings as dentists reveal new tooth decay treatment. Scientists in London develop pain-free fillings that allow teeth to repair themselves without drilling or injections. We're also going to look at chelation therapy and vitamin supplements. A new study shows it can cut heart disease rate by 25%. A lot of Americans suffer from liver disease. Well, now there's new information on probiotics that can prevent deadly complications of liver disease. A lot of people have bad breath, and one of the reasons we have bad breath is because of candida. A lot of people have infections. A lot of people can't sleep well. A lot of people have bloating and distension. Again, from candida. So how to eliminate candida naturally, and a lot more on health and nutrition. Then we're going to have a look at a recipe for ripoffs. This is from Emily Schwartz Greco, and it's about the deals that amount to NAFTA on steroids, benefiting only corporations and hurting the rest of us. The North American Free Trade Agreement, it was bad, it was terrible, and the very people who supported it now support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We'll tell you why we should not be supporting any of these today. Then, how the Department of Homeland Security became America's standing army. From activist post John Whitehead, a commentary. Also, you've heard a lot about the Bilderberg Group. Mainly, it is stated that this is a group affiliated with many other conspiratorial groups, and they want one world government. Well, yes and no. From Russell Baker, who is very spot on, a simple look at the Bilderberg Group and what they really represent, and what power they have. Also today, we're going to have a guest. This is going to be an education. My guest is Allison Weyer, and we're going to talk about the untold story in history of how the United States helped create the State of Israel, and why the U.S. is stuck in a quagmire with the Israeli lobby. It is almost an impossibility to get an honest evaluation of the problems in the Middle East and a truthful analysis of Israel's participation. But Allison does that. And we also will be quoting information from the originators of the State of Israel and our State Department, our top political analysts and diplomats, saying why we should do it differently, and how President Truman did not choose to use any of their advice, and the consequences. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Just imagine going to a dentist. Think of the drill. Think of the pain, unless you get it numbed. Now there's something brand new. According to The Guardian, scientists have developed a new pain-free filling that allows cavities to repair without drilling or injections. The tooth rebuilding technique developed at King's College London does away with fillings and instead encourages teeth to repair themselves. Now, we know the tooth decay is normally removed by drilling, after which the cavity is filled with a material such as composite resin or, unfortunately, amalgam mercury fillings. The new treatment, called electrically accelerated and enhanced remineralization, accelerates the natural movement of calcium and phosphate minerals into the damaged tooth. A A two-step process first prepares the damaged area of enamel, then uses tiny electric current to push minerals into the repair site. So this is really interesting. Quote from Professor Nigel Pitts of King's College London's Dental Institute, "The way we treat teeth today is not ideal. When we repair a tooth by putting in a filling, that tooth enters a cycle of drilling and refilling as ultimately each repair fails. Not only is our device kinder to the patient and better for their teeth, but it's expected to be at least as cost-effective as current dental treatments." So now they're using electrical stimulation to remineralize the tooth. That's very interesting. For decades, any physician in the United States who used chelation therapy on a patient was deemed practicing quackery, but there was no science. And that was a major target of the so-called quackbusters. No background, no experience, no credibility in a given area, but were accepted by the media as expert, more so than a board-certified physician having decades of experience in a given field. The bias was terrible. By the way, every single lawsuit that these quackbusters have been sued, they've lost. And interesting how in one, the California top court put it right on the record. These people do not have expertise in these areas. So just be wary of anything that a quackbuster or a skeptic. These skeptic organizations are all pro-orthodoxy. In any case, they finally have a study. And this was published in the American Heart Journal. First, it looked at combinations of high-dose minerals and vitamins and chelation therapy to see could it protect the heart attack and or protect from heart attack or protect people who have had heart attacks from future events and death. It was a multiple study, and it was done in many different centers. Now, for this audience, you know that intravenous chelation, which is the chemical name for ethylene diamine tetracyclic acid, or EDTA, is injected into the bloodstream in order to bind to minerals and help flush them out of the body. Now, this was not supported at all by any medical organization for decades. In fact, the FDA actually approved chelation for heavy metal poisoning. It was first used during World War I. And since 1956, practitioners of complementary or alternative medicine have used it to treat atherosclerotic disease, hardening of the arteries, in part on the idea that the therapy might help flush out mineral deposits that lead to arterial hardening. And because there has been limited research to support this practice, and the FDA has not approved it, they did a study. Quote, heavy metals are associated very well in epidemiologic data with cardiovascular events, and particularly lead, cadmium, arsenic, sometimes mercury, and others that have less evidence. And this was according to Dr. Lamas of Columbia University's Division of Cardiology at Mount Sinai Medical Center. Quote, they're all in our environment, meaning heavy metals. And any of us who are of an age to have been exposed to leaded gasoline have lead in our bones. If we get an infusion of EDTA, we'll have lead in our urine. It's just the way it is. And as you get older and become osteoporotic, this lead is bad and it's released. Now, here's what they found. Quote, in a randomized, double-blind trial, the researchers assigned 1,708 stable heart attack survivors to 134 different clinics across the United States. And they were given high-dose oral multiple vitamins plus chelation and or chelation plus a mimicked, meaning a placebo. And what they found was that there was a substantial improvement. So now, for those of you who've been receiving chelation therapy, it's real, it works, they have it, it's a double-blind, placebo-controlled, it was done at all these different centers, it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, so enough of the doubt. The doctors were right all along. The medical community was wrong all along. All the top cardiologists were wrong. The federal agencies were wrong. And the quackbusters have never been right about anything. So the public now gets the truth. But it took decades and a lot of denigration and a lot of smear campaigns against good people who were ahead of the curve. Chelation therapy works. We have the science on our side. A new article published in the journal Clinical Gastroenterology and Hepatology found that probiotics, the good bacteria, helps prevent deadly complications of liver disease, and especially with cirrhosis of the liver. Now, you consider how many Americans drink and end up with liver inflammation, scarring in the liver, dead liver tissue. So you need something to protect. Quote, the rigorous new research finds that probiotics modify the gut microbiota to prevent hepatic, meaning liver, disease in patients with cirrhosis of the liver. The results offer a safe, well-tolerated, and perhaps cheaper alternative to current treatments. End quote. That's really exciting because they're saying you don't need the drugs. There's something natural, non-toxic, and expensive, probiotics. So for all of you who were detoxifying under the care of holistic clinicians, and you were drinking your juices, you were drinking in the probiotics, you were doing the right thing. Now, something that has been the scourge of tens of millions of people is candida. It's bad. How do you get candida? Well, it's relatively easy. It's a natural form of yeast in the body. The more sugar you eat, which yeast feeds on, the more candida. When you consume alcohol, candida. When you have taking oral contraceptives, the same. When you're stressed, the same. Or when you take antibiotics, it kills off the friendly bacteria, allowing candida to multiply. It's called candida albicans, and it's also one of the reasons that people have eczema, bad breath, constipation, fungus under the nails. In fact, here are some symptoms that means that your body's overproducing candida, and therefore you should be on a protocol. Allergies and sensitivities and tolerances. If they get worse when it's damp or muggy, or if you're around a moldy place. Hay fever and asthma. If you have an intolerance to perfumes and odors. If you walk into a clothing store and you have a reaction. Dogs and cats, intolerance to their fur, hair. In babies, colic, diaper rash. It's also called thrush when the tongue is white and coated. And if you bruise easily, if you're cold in your hands and feet, you have a lower body temperature. If you have cysts and abnormal formations in different parts of the body, especially around the neck, the throat, the ovaries. If you have diarrhea, constipation, bloating, pain, mucus in the stools. If you have ringing in the ears. If you have flu-like symptoms. If you have hair loss and you find that your scalp has a little flakiness, like dandruff, or scalp sores or dryness. If you have migraine headaches or hemorrhoids, low blood sugar, hypoglycemia, these are some of the conditions that you may not realize are directly associated with candida, including mouth sores and blisters, white coating on the tongue, muscle aches, nasal congestion. Now, why does it cause this? The causes of immune system dysfunction, antibiotic use, probably the biggest would be sugar use and antibiotic abuse, because candida is resistant to antibiotics. The imbalance of microorganisms means that you're going to kill off the good bacteria, cause a proliferation of the bad bacteria. So what do you do? Well, first and foremost, get rid of all the foods and beverages in the diet that feed candida, all the refined carbohydrates, the gluten, and the sugars. Remember, the number one food feeding candida is sugar in all forms, also in dairy products. Artificial sweeteners, also get rid of them. Most of the people I've ever counseled who have candida also have gluten intolerances. You have to understand what gluten really is. It's an elastic and gluey protein found in wheat. It's also found in rye and barley and oats and spelt and kamut. And it's in a lot of ingredients. And gluten grains feed candida because they have a high glycemic index, meaning high natural sugars. So what do you do about it? Well, first, eat more living foods. Drink 3 to 5 glasses of juice a day. The best juice I have found for fighting candida is grapefruit, green apple, lemon, all together. Also, try to avoid yeast, mold, and fungus. Have the good oils, like coconut oil is really good. Almond oil, walnut oil, flaxseed oil. Get the good essential fatty acids, the omega-3s. Get away from all trans fats, like margarine and safflower oil. If I had one oil to help a person that had a yeast overgrowth, it would be coconut oil. It is just terrific. It kills off yeast overgrowth. It supports the immune system. And it's easily digested. Avoid soybean and soybean-based products. And the supplements would be chlorella, vitamin B complex, generally 50 milligrams, vitamin C, probably up to 5 to 10,000 milligrams a day in divided doses, vitamin D, vitamin E, twice a day, calcium, magnesium, garlic, and raw apple cider vinegar. In fact, just taking a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar and putting it into your juice really kills off intestinal yeast and also helps with all forms of candida in your gut. Olive leaf extract. Olive leaf extract, in my opinion, is one of the best single extracts that you can have and should have. It kills fungus, and it contains phenolic compounds, the oleouropene, which has antiviral, antifungal, antiprotozoal, and antibacterial qualities. Padiarco, that's P-A-U-D-A-R-C-O. It's the bark of a rainforest tree, which is strongly antifungal. And then aloe vera, whole leaf aloe vera is good. Now, if you have a really bad case of candida, then drink 2 glasses a day, 12 to 16 ounces of raw organic cabbage juice. That is terrific. And then you watch what happens and should see things clear up. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about a simple herb that improves libido in women and how it works, why it's important. Also, the Topways mushrooms help fight cancer. Additionally, nuts increase cognitive scores among elderly women. So we have a lot on health and healing coming tomorrow. Now I want to take on from our environmental segment a short piece from Emily Schwartz Greco and William Collins, published in Other Words. It's called Recipe for Ripoff. Here's what it says. President Barack Obama is surprisingly devout to free trade. During his first presidential bid, he promised to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, indicating some concern over the U.S.-Canada-Mexican pact. A month after his 2009 inauguration, Obama declared that he would, quote, be very careful and take his time meeting that goal. Instead, he crossed fixing that accord off his to-do list and became the world cheerleader for new deals that amount to NAFTA on steroids. So you could say, so what? What's the big deal? The United States has inked free trade deals with 20 countries over the past three decades. This country plunged headfirst into the World Trade Organization before it formed a study by independent nonpartisan people to see whether or not we should. It's now clear that this zeal benefits corporations and it hurts all the rest of us. These accords stoke inequality by driving down wages. The United States exported nearly 700,000 jobs between NAFTA's 1994 debut and 2010, despite promises that it would expand employment. Following 25 years of stagnation, typical household income remains at about the same. Free trade deals hand corporations a shield to fend off national regulations, hitching its fortune to rules rigged by the Dominican Republic Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA. A Canadian-based mining company called Pacific Rim claims to have the right to dig for gold in El Salvador, even though that country has banned all of this to protect its meager supply of drinking water. Pacific Rim is suing El Salvador for $300 million. The proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership deal could render this kind of corporate power grab routine. The pact would skew global economic rules for a dozen countries, including our own and Japan, which account for about 40% of world trade. Among other things, this deal would make it easier for corporations to use investor-to-state lawsuits like the El Salvador debacle to get their way over the objections of foreign governments. This is a recipe for ripoffs. It's not about trade. And that's the point. These arrangements are a gimmick intended to trump local and national laws to suit the whims of corporations. That's why merely five of the looming Trans-Pacific deal's 29 chapters have much to do with trade. The rest hang big companies, hand them privileges and protection. With people taking a back seat to profits, it's no wonder our leaders are negotiating pacts like this behind closed doors. When WikiLeaks spilled the beans on the Trans-Pacific Partnership's environmental chapter, it turned out this deal included weaker safeguards than its predecessors, outraging people who spend their lives fighting for cleaner air and water. The Obama administration is also pursuing the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with European nations. Those talks are just a secret, and that pact would also make it easier for corporations to override environmental safeguards by suing foreign governments to get their way. Why is WikiLeaks rooting around for these documents and releasing them to the public? The pacts will require Senate approval, yet lawmakers have had to beg for any details about them. And based upon leaks, other big concerns center around health issues. For example, some provisions would block government policies to discourage smoking. There are also many concerns about labor rights. Meanwhile, hundreds of corporate insiders get a seat at the table without making a fuss. A list of 605 big business insiders leaked last year offers a glimpse of the scope of this influence. Well, here's just a few. The American Farm Bureau and the Nuclear Energy Institute are among the who's who of corporate America. Abbott Laboratories, Caterpillar, Walmart. Yes, they're all there. Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza, Taco Bell also made the list. While environmentalists, activists, labor leaders, not one invited in. Now, my final thought on this is simple. Let's just say that you are a country like El Salvador, and you have had no new mining. You've closed down mines because the trailings and other pollution from the mining operations were polluting people's drinking water all over the country. Well, that's a good thing. How rare is it when a country, an entire country, decides to put its people first, profits of special interest second? Now in comes a company that says, we are going to drill where we want, when we want, as much as we want, and we're going to take all the gold we can out, And, we're not going to do anything about the pollution. But you can't do anything because there's going to be a treaty, and we're signatories of the treaty, and you're going to have to pay us what our lost profits would be. And even though we haven't drilled a single site yet, we're estimating we're going to lose $300 million. So you must give us $300 million, even though we haven't spent a nickel. And in all likelihood, they will win. Why will they win? Because who are the judges? What court is it that you settle this at? Well, it's not really a court, and these are not judges. The arbiters, and there is no appeal from their decision. Hence, they have more power than the U.S. Supreme Court. These are lawyers working for these major multinational corporations. So a lawyer working for a major corporation that has an inherent conflict of interest will decide. What doesn't take much to realize who they're going to side with, not we the people. So now you may be forced to cough up money you don't have, or to allow your environment, pristine environments, to be exploited. That is what President Obama is saying. He is coming down on the side of the people that have always supported him, and he's always supported them. Big business. But he's still charming people, just like Bill Clinton. No matter what the deeds of that man is, he's now considered probably the most popular president since FDR. But don't look at his record. Just look at his charm. This is an interesting piece. This is from Aaron Klein from WND.com. Blowback. U.S. trained ISIS at secret Jordan base. I was waiting for something like this to be exposed. First, a little overview. Do you remember when those of us who could see with ease what would likely happen if we had allowed NATO to go in and destroy the ruling groups inside of Libya? And why? Well, it has the largest freshwater aquifer in that part of Africa, and secondly, it has enormous amounts of oil. And we said you have over 200 different ethnic groups that are going to then start their own conflicts to go after these resources. And there were no terrorists there. But we didn't listen, we the American people. Instead, we caused change in power. Look at the country today. Absolute total anarchy and chaos. But then, what happened to all those weapons that Gaddafi had? The jihadists got it, the extremists got it, and then they started to come in from around the African area, including Mali, and they began to organize. From there, then it was, let's go in and get more going in Syria. And now from Syria, now they're going into Iraq. But we have a very short memory, and we don't like to get too close at observing a problem because we start seeing the very people who are appearing all the time on the fascistic network, Fox Network, and the pundit talking heads who caused all this mess. And they're saying more military action. That's where this story picks up. Quote, members of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIS, were trained in 2012 by U.S. instructors working at a secret base in Jordan, according to informed Jordanian officials. The official says dozens of ISIS members were trained at the time as part of a covert aid to the insurgents targeting the regime of Syrian President Bashar Assad in Syria. The official said the training was not meant to be used for any future campaign in Iraq. The Jordanian official said all ISIS members who receive U.S. training to fight in Syria were first vetted for any links to extremist groups like Al-Qaeda. In February 2012, it was shown that Turkey and Jordan were running a training base for the Syrian rebels in the Jordanian town of Safawi in the country's northeast desert. The report has since been corroborated by numerous other media accounts. Last March, the German weekly Der Spiegel reported Americans were training Syrian rebels in Jordan. Quoting what it said were training participants and organizers, Der Spiegel reported it was not clear whether the Americans worked for private firms or were with the U.S. Army. But the magazine said some organizers wore uniforms. The training in Jordan reportedly focused on the use of anti-tank weaponry. The German magazine reported 200 men received the training over the previous 3 months amid U.S. plans to train a total of 1,200 members of the Free Syrian Army in two camps in the south and east of Jordan. Britain's Guardian newspaper also reported last March the U.S. trainers were aiding Syrian rebels in Jordan, along with British and French instructors. Reuters reported a spokesman for the U.S. Defense Department declined immediate comment on the German magazine's report. The French Foreign Ministry and Britain's Foreign Defense Ministries decided not to comment. ISIS previously posted a video on YouTube threatening to move on Jordan and slaughter King Abdullah, whom they viewed as an enemy of Islam. And then Saudi Arabia has been arming ISIS, and that the Saudis are a driving force in supporting Al-Qaeda-linked groups. It is also now known, according to a Shiite source, in contact with a high official of the government of Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, the Obama administration has been aware for 2 months that the Al-Qaeda-inspired group that has taken over two Iraqi cities and now threatening Baghdad also was training fighters in Turkey. The source told us that at least one of the training camps of the group was the Islamic State of Iraq, and that ISIS is in the vicinity of an Air Force base in Turkey, where American personnel and equipment are located. He called Obama, quote, an accomplice in the attacks that are threatening the Maliki government the U.S. helped establish through the Iraq War. Now, this is what this is saying, so we're clear on this. What you keep hearing about every day, this relatively small group, I think they started with about 700 in Iraq, it might have 4,000 to 6,000 everywhere. And there's no way in the world that they could possibly overtake Baghdad. It's not possible because, A, there's only so many routes to get there. And to get there in the back of these pickup trucks mounted with machine guns, they would end up with the same fate as the Iraqi army did when it invaded Kuwait. And tens of thousands were killed because there's only one road. Everything else is desert, and they just got strafed by the Air Force. So you've got the Iraqi special units, drones, U.S., and they're just waiting for these people to get vulnerable, and then they'll just obliterate them. But no one's talking about where did these people get their training? Where did they get their weapons? Who's financing them? And of course, now we know, just as we did with the Mujahideen, and when it came to helping Afghanistan rebels to get rid of Russia, we are, and France is, and Great Britain is. Ah, so then you hear about giving weapons and training to moderate Islamic radicals. Well, that's fine, except they don't exist. And these people are smart enough to realize they're getting huge amounts of money, training, and then they decide to do what they want to do. Sooner or later, someone in the mainstream media may actually report this story, but I wouldn't hold my breath. From a good piece in Common Dreams by Caesar Shalala, Why President Bush and Tony Blair Should Be Prosecuted for War Crimes. This is a short piece, but it says something that none of the mainstream media in America has done. Quote, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair recently stated that airstrikes and drones should be used once again on Iraq to stem recent gains by extremists in that country. Mr. Blair is oblivious of the responsibility he shares with former President George Bush on account of one of the most serious breaches of international law in recent times. The prosecution of Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush, along with the lines of similar trials conducted in Argentina, Chile, and Peru is the only fitting response to such careless remarks. A reminder of Iraq's tragic events is in order. George Bush and his advisors were planning a premeditated attack on Iraq to secure regime change even before he took power in January of 2001. Such a plan is described in detail in the document, quote, Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, written in 2000 by the neoconservative think tank Project for the New American Century. In January 2003, a group of U.S. law professors warned President Bush that he and senior officials of his government could be prosecuted for war crimes if military intervention were to be done because it would violate international humanitarian law. Similar warnings were given to British Prime Minister Tony Blair and to a Canadian Prime Minister also by the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights. The prosecution case finds strong support in both treaty law and customary international law as reflected in the UN Charter and the Nuremberg Principles. The UN Charter, a treaty ratified by the U.S. in 1945 by the U.S. and its main coalition and allies, is widely considered the foundation of modern international law. Article 2 of the UN Charter bans the use of force in no uncertain terms, except when justified under specific and well-defined conditions. Quote, All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. End quote. Accordingly, in the absence of an armed attack against the United States or the coalition members, any use or threat of the use of force must find support by a special UN Security Council resolution authorizing such an exceptional course of action. Such authorization was never sought nor never obtained, prompting UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to affirm in September 2004, quote, from our point of view and the UN Charter point of view, the Iraqi war is illegal, end quote. In February 2006, Luis Manero Acapanpo, at the time the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, acknowledged having received 240 communications reporting various war crimes committed in March 2003. U.S. and U.K. officials argued at the time that existing U.N. Security Council resolutions issued in connection with and after the first Persian Gulf War had authorized the invasion. The Nuremberg Principles, which codified long-lasting principles of customary international law, also incriminate the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, many of them children, and the devastation of a country's infrastructure on the war sponsored by President Bush and Prime Minister Blair. In conclusion, the conduct and consequences of the Iraq War are part of the, quote, crimes against peace and war crimes, codified in Nuremberg Principle 6, defining, quote, crimes against peace, quote, planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression or a war in violation of international treaties, agreements, or assurances, participation in a common plan or conspiracy for the accomplishment of any of the acts mentioned under. The United States is not a party to the Rome Statute and the International Criminal Court created by this treaty. Yet, as suggested by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, U.S. officials may be prosecuted in other countries under the Geneva Convention. Ratner likened the prosecution of Mr. Blair and Bush for those crimes to the prosecution of Chilean military dictator Augusto Pinochet, held under house arrest in London under the orders of the Spanish magistrate, Garzón. International treaties ratified by the United States are part of the, quote, supreme law of the land, and, as recalled by Justice Jackson, the chief U.S. Nuremberg Tribunal prosecutor, quote, launching a war of aggression is a crime, and no political or economic situation can justify it. Arguably, prosecuting a former U.S. president and a former British prime minister for war crimes is not practical and is likely to cause significant unrest both at the national and global levels. However, three Latin American countries, Argentina, Chile, and Peru, successfully tried and convicted former leaders to prison for crimes of much less magnitude than those involved in the Iraq War. Perhaps the United States and the United Kingdom could follow on those Latin American countries' footsteps. And Cesar Chalela is an MD, PhD, and co-winner of the Overseas Press Club of America Award. And he is also the foreign correspondent for Middle East Times International. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back with my guest. We're going to talk about the untold story and history of how the United States helped create the State of Israel and why the U.S. is stuck in a quagmire with the Israeli lobby. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. All over the world, we're sharing information and insights with individuals. Coming now from Northern California is my guest, Allison Weyer. Allison is a journalist, a civil rights and peace activist, and president of the Council for the National Interest. She is also the founder of the organization Americans New, which analyzes and reports on U.S. media coverage of Israel and Palestine. She has had presentations before Congress on the U.S. and Israeli-Palestinian crisis. She's lectured at Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, Yale, Berkeley, and to academies and institutions overseas. She has received a variety of awards, including the Phi Alpha Literary Society for Courageous Journalism on behalf of human rights. Her articles have appeared in Counterpunch and Antiwar.com and Project Censored as well. She is also the author of a recent book, Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. Nice to have you with us today, Allison.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show.
After reading about some of the statistics in the numerous ways the U.S. financially supports Israel and the unchallenged power the Israeli lobby has on our elected officials and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, the question that is certainly in my mind, and I would hope with the listeners right now, is what was the past history that brought the United States to be more of a servant and funder for Israel against many of the interests of other developed and developing nations? And how can a country the size of New Jersey hold so much power over our electorate? How is it that we can give $8.5 million a day to Israel, which has a better employment rate than the United States, when the U.S. Today remains in a recession with no signs of economic growth, and where the real history that I read in your article on what was going on behind the scenes and how virtually all the major politicians within the State Department and within our government and the advisors of the president, including the famous General Marshall, that the Marshall Plan was named after, all were against this. And yet we only know that it happened. We don't know how it happened. So could you take us first through this history?
Sure, I'd be glad to. It's truly an astounding history. I got interested in this subject about 13 or 14 years ago when the second Palestinian uprising began, and I just got curious about what it all was about in fall of 2000. Began looking into the issue for myself. My background is journalism. I ended up going over as a freelance reporter and traveled by myself throughout Gaza and the West Bank in early 2001. And I saw the extremely violent actions by the Israeli forces against a largely unarmed population. So when I came back to the U.S., I began this organization called If Americans Knew. And I also began researching the whole issue intensely. I sometimes get curious about things and just read as much as I can. So I started reading all sorts of very reliable books about the history of this conflict, and I especially was looking into the U.S. connection, how this, you know, what's typically called a special relationship, and really it's a unique relationship, was created. And what I discovered is that the movement to create Israel and then to maintain Israel has been in this country well over a century. It began in the late 1800s. It began about the same time as the political Zionism began in Europe, and was significant in the United States in the 1880s already. It was very significant by the 1910s, where there were a great deal of Zionists in the United States, and these, 20,000. They included businessmen, lawyers, academics, people with clout. And already by that time, politicians, especially in the large cities, especially large eastern cities, were paying attention to this political movement. I also discovered that from the beginning, it was opposed by the State Department and by the Pentagon and eventually by the intelligence agencies, because quite clearly it was damaging to the U.S. It really was not anything that benefited the United States, and therefore various diplomats and high-level State Department officials, the Secretary of Defense, all recommended against supporting Zionism. So it's very interesting because it began such a long time ago. Some of the work on behalf of this political movement to create a Jewish state on land that when it began was 95% non-Jewish. The movement on behalf of that in our country was used a variety of means. On the one hand, sometimes it was very public, but in many cases it used very secretive methods to push this agenda. And fortunately, there are many books that contain the information about that that I've now used in writing my own book about the subject.
Let's go through some of the heavy hitters, including Lou Henderson, the director of the State Department Near Eastern Affairs, and General George Marshall, Truman's Secretary of State, and Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson, and Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, and George Kennan, and Henry Grady, regarded at the time as the U.S.'s top diplomat of the Cold War, and so many others, who were uniformly against what was going to happen there, because they knew that if you give power to Israel and you deny the fact that 95% of the country was inhabited and have been for a long time by Palestinians, that in effect you were setting the groundwork for what later would become the world's largest outdoor apartheid prison. Your thoughts, please.
That's right. That's, they predicted accurately what would happen, and it did happen. But, as you said, there was, for example, Loy Henderson was the high-level diplomat. He was in charge of the Near and Middle East department in the State Department. He emphasized that we would lose our moral standards in the world if we supported Zionism. He said that we would be, quote, a betrayer of the high principles, which we ourselves have enunciated during the period of the war. He was, in that case, referring to World War II. He said that that Zionist proposals were violated various principles laid down in the UN Charter, as well as, quote, principles on which American concepts of government are based. He noted that these would violate self-determination and majority rule. He also said that these would be very damaging to the United States. He said these in a number of written documents. That's how we know that they were said. In document after document, he made these statements and recommendations. And he was not alone, as he wrote at one point, that he represented really the vast majority of State Department analysts on this issue. He was, as you mentioned, there was Ambassador Henry Grady, who has been called, quote, America's top diplomatic soldier for a critical period of the Cold War. He wrote about what happened when he tried to oppose the Zionist lobby, and he said, quote, this is Henry Grady, I have had a good deal of experience with lobbies, but this group, meaning the Zionist lobby, started where those of my experience have ended, wrote Grady, quote, I have headed a number of government missions, but in no other have I ever experienced so much disloyalty. He said, in the United States, since there is no political force to counterbalance Zionism, its campaigns are apt to be decisive. Dean Acheson, who was a Undersecretary of State, a very high-level diplomat for many years, there's a U.S. postage stamp that honors Dean Acheson. He wrote that he was very worried that, quote, the West would pay a high price for Israel. He wrote that supporting Zionism would, quote, vastly exacerbate the political problem and imperil not only American but all Western interests in the New East. The Joint Chiefs of Staff wrote similar things. They wrote that this would prejudice U.S. strategic interests in the Middle East, to the point that the United States' influence in the area would be curtailed to that which could be maintained only by military force. The Joint Chiefs issued at least 16 papers on the Palestine issue, all of them critical of Zionism. You know, there's a statement, there was a report after report, memo after memo, by high-level officials in the U.S. government opposing Zionism, and yet almost nobody knows this today, although it's very knowable. You know, people, Noam Chomsky is an example, who write about this issue, completely hide this reality. It's hard for me to think it's unknown to him. Now, other people, of course, don't even know about it. But it's a very significant factor to understand.
Allison, I'd like you to address two issues, please, that most people in this audience are simply unaware of. And that is, we tend to have the belief that terrorism was developed and originated among Arab and Muslim groups, but was it not Begin, who was a Menachem Begin, the prime minister, who bragged that it was the Zionists who brought terrorism to both the Middle East and the world? Is that accurate?
And is it
also not true that when you look at the careful, detailed scholarship on this, that it was the armed aggression and the ethnic cleansing of at least 750,000 indigenous Palestinians that created the Jewish state on land that had been 95% non-Jewish prior to Zionist immigration, and that after years of immigration remained 70% non-Jewish? Is that accurate or not?
That's correct. Begin was interviewed on American television by an American journalist who asked Begin, and let's remind people who might not remember this. Menachem Begin became Prime Minister of Israel. Before that time, before Israel existed, because Israel was just created through warfare in 1948, before that time, Menachem Begin was the head of a terrorist organization called the Irgun. You know, he was publicly the head of that organization that took credit for killing a great many civilians of all sorts, Jewish, Palestinian, British officials. They were really extremely violent. So he was interviewed after he was prime minister on American TV, and the interviewer asked him, how does it feel to have originated terrorism in the Middle East? And Begin responded, quote, not just the Middle East, in the world. He took credit for, you know, the amount of terrorism that exists throughout the world. Now, maybe he was exaggerating what he had done worldwide, but certainly he was not exaggerating what he did in the Middle East. This is,
Allison, my final question is that... My final question is this. Why is it that virtually every candidate, every member of Congress, with only a few exceptions, every president, vice president, simply toes the line to the American Jewish lobby, and no one sees the true and honest history? They get a sanitized, completely revised history of Israel. Your thoughts?
Well, it's because, you know, from a century of manipulation, and I hope people will buy my book. It's under $10 on Amazon. It's, you can read it very quickly. It's thoroughly cited with something like, I think, about 300 footnotes for people to see exactly where I got my information. The fact is that there's been a century of well-funded manipulation of our country, targeting every single sector. Originally, by the way, Zionists were not embraced by Jewish Americans and were opposed by Jewish Americans, although eventually that changed. But it's been a massive manipulation, and most of us have no idea it was occurring. So that today we have the Zionist narrative, which now is the pro-Israel narrative, dominates the U.S. media, dominates our magazines, such as the Weider publications, which own all the popular American history magazines in the country, are owned by a group that is actively pro-Israel. I've written an article about that. And most of us really have never followed this issue. Because of that, donors, as we know, campaigns are influenced by how much money you get. And politicians are very aware that if they talk at all critically of Israel, that a great deal of campaign money will be mobilized to go to their opponent, who then will have the best campaign that money can buy. And this happens on both sides of the aisle. It's both Democrats and Republicans. In both cases, we have had individuals that have tried to speak out. In some cases, they have survived. It's not 100%. There are some people that are in Congress that occasionally oppose the Israel lobby very quietly, and they're still in office. But in many cases, once that was done, they were targeted by campaign donations that went to their opponents. They lost the election, and they were pushed out. This has been done against both Democrats and Republicans, and it continues today. And most of us don't even know what's going on and don't vote on that issue.
Well, I want to recommend your book, because it is, I've read all your quotes and comments and footnotes, and this is an eye-opener. The book is called Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. The website, ifamericansknew.org. My guest, Allison Weir, spelled W-E-I-R. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate this. A multi-award-winning journalist who's told the truth. And my bet is that there'll be no major media covering her story. I'm Gary Nall. We cover all the stories that are important for people who want to know the truth. Thank you very much for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrece Lead, who is standing by. Hi, Utrece.
Hi, Gary. A great program. Today we're talking about why the Clintons must answer for their roles in the crisis in Iraq.
And Rwanda.
And a whole bunch of other things. But since Iraq is in our sights, in the crosshairs right now, it's important to remember that they had major roles in creating this debacle.
One of the worst of all is that it was under President Clinton that we saw secret documents that were released showing that they intended to knock out Iraq's infrastructure of water and power that was not in a military district, it was in a civilian district, with the hope that enough people would see their children get sick or die, that they would rebel. That goes against the Geneva Convention of targeting civilians. They were never held accountable, and 500,000, as a half a million children, died. When Leslie Stahl asked Madeleine Albright, at the time, it was Secretary, who was the ambassador. She said, is that acceptable? And she said, yes. Well, that was such a clarion moment. So there is nothing that I would put past the Clintons. We look forward to your comments and your investigation on this. Utrece Lead, right now. Please stay with us.